Welcome to the Physiological Reviews podcast. I'm Kara Hansel-Keehan. Today, we'll discuss the recently published article titled Leveraging Physiology and Artificial Intelligence to Deliver Advancements in Healthcare. Joining me are guest host Dr. Ryan Melvin and author Dr. James Zoe. Let's learn more. Dr. Melvin?
Thank you, Kara. Dr. James Zoe is a recognized authority in computer science and artificial intelligence with biomedical applications. His recent publication in Physiological Reviews, as you mentioned, provides an in-depth overview of AI's current contributions and future challenges in healthcare, which has been pivotal in guiding discussions around AI's potential in the medical world. We're indeed privileged to have James with us today. James, let's begin by discussing the historical milestones of AI. Can you elaborate on the key events in AI and physiology that led to the current surge of AI in healthcare?
Yes, well, first, thank you very much for having me, Kara and Ryan. I'm really excited to be here and have this discussion. I think it's a really exciting time, right, for AI in physiology and AI in medicine more broadly. There's already over 500 AI algorithms and devices that are approved by the FDA, right, to be used in patients. So many people might be surprised that it's already so many hundreds of AI algorithms that are FDA approved. And most of these have been approved in the last 2 or 3 years, right? So these are already relatively mature algorithms that have been approved by the FDA so they can be deployed in hospitals in different settings. And I think that like the historical trend of this is really happening really just over the last 5 to 10 years, right? There's like a big change in AI basically about 10 years ago in the development of these deep learning models, which are really essentially a type of AI algorithms that are very well suited in learning from large amount of data, especially imaging data and data from signals, right? From like EKG type signals. And then around 2 or 3 years ago, there's also another surge of AI that's more focused on language models, right? So these are things like ChatGPT that are really very powerful understanding natural texts and queries, which might be things written, for example, like from medical records, doctor's notes, or questions that patients might ask, right? So I think these two things that are converged over the last year or so that's really led to this huge explosion of exciting applications of AI in physiology and in medicine.
Awesome. Let's talk a little bit maybe about the role that physiology data has played in some of those advancements and what's next. For example, how do you see AI's potential in automating existing healthcare tasks, increasing access to care, and augmenting the current capabilities?
Yeah, so thanks for that question. I think there's a lot of really exciting data that are readily collected in medicine and physiology, right? Especially a lot of imaging data, data from different devices, right? So in the one area that I've done a lot of work on is sort of cardiovascular diseases, where, for example, there are these ultrasound videos, so it's called echocardiographs, that are routinely collected. There are many millions of these collected every year in the US and many hundreds of millions, tens of millions around the world. And a lot of data that are collected in medicine, including these videos, are extremely content rich. In a sense that, you know, if you look at these videos or images, they can capture a lot of interesting information about the patient's physiology, about their health status. And oftentimes, you know, in the past, we have relied on human doctors to manually inspect very content-rich data, right? So maybe like a cardiologist or sonographer would spend a long time to look at each of these videos. And there's a limited amount of things that we're trained to extract from these very content-rich imaging data. And this is where I think where AI can be and has been the most powerful is to come in, right? They're very good at finding patterns, subtle patterns in these very content-rich imaging and video data. And they can extract those patterns and then explain it back to the clinicians and to the patients and to flag important parts of the information so that the human experts can then focus their attention on the most important part of the data.
What are some of the tasks that you see being automated out of that data?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So, you know, I mentioned that there are over 500 FDA-approved medical AI algorithms. And we've actually done like a survey of what are the kinds of tasks they are trying to do. And many of these algorithms are approved to automate specific kinds of image analysis. For example, you take X-ray image or ultrasound video or CT scan, and sometimes the doctors and clinicians want to look at specific part of the image. Right, so then the AI would do what's called segmentation. And the goal of a segmentation is to basically look at the video or look at the image, contour out the outline of a particular part of that image, maybe a particular part of the tumor or a particular heart chamber that might be the most relevant. So previously, that kind of segmentation would require having a human clinician to do that drawing by hand, which can be variable and time expensive and takes a lot of labor to do. And the AI algorithm would come in and to do that automatic segmentation to draw the contours. Right? So then that makes it easier and faster for the human clinicians to make downstream diagnosis and assessments.
One more follow-up question on that line. Those examples that you talk through, I think, are all things that in some ways humans can do already. We're just talking about the AI making it more efficient. Are there any things that you think are new that we will start doing because of AI that we haven't done before?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I think you're right in that the first and the current generation of AI in medicine have mostly been focusing on helping us to automate and speed up things that humans can do well, but it takes us time and energy to do, right? And I think that's like a good initial application of AI. Our colleagues and including my students, postdocs, have also been exploring areas, other applications of AI. They're looking at things that might be surprising to the human physicians and doctors. Right? So for example, one of the things I mentioned is we developed algorithms to look at ultrasound videos of the heart. But it turns out that when you look at these ultrasound videos of the heart, these echoes, you can actually learn a lot about other organs in the body beyond the heart, right? Because the whole human body is very much interconnected. And one of the things that our AI algorithm showed is that you can actually predict all sorts of lab values that previously required taking different blood measurements, right? Looking at liver function and other organs. You can predict those lab values actually pretty well by looking at the ultrasound videos of the heart. So that's not something that a human doctor will be able to do. And it would be surprising to us that you could do this, but the algorithm is able to find patterns in those images in the videos that enables it to make these predictions of these surprising phenotypes. And I think that's actually one interesting new direction for AI is to be able to help us to do more precise phenotyping of individual patients by leveraging this capability to predict all sorts of interesting morphologies and different behaviors from a more standard set of measurements.
It's a really interesting example. It also seemed to me that you were taking invasive measurements, like most lab values require some element of an invasive procedure, and you're making those non-invasive. That was really cool. Thank you for that example.
Just to follow up quickly, I think that's actually a good direction of AI is that we want to use AI to make precision medicine more accessible, right? And a part of that is to make it much cheaper and less invasive to be able to predict and to generate all sorts of interesting phenotype data, right? Especially data that would be expensive or invasive to collect otherwise, then AI can help us to essentially impute those values from much simpler data modalities.
It's amazing. One of the crucial points that you raised in the review is the shift from model development to model deployment. Can you delve deeper into the challenges of deploying AI models in clinical settings and especially the regulatory considerations that come into play?
Yeah. So I think that's a really important transition that we're facing now. Because our ultimate goal, right, as researchers and developers of these algorithms is that we really want for these algorithms to have a real world impact, right, to improve patient outcomes and to improve our healthcare process. And to achieve that impact, then it's not enough just to develop these tools and write the code, but we also need to have these tools integrated into the healthcare workflow so they can have this real world impact. I mentioned that there are over 500 FDA-approved AI algorithms, right? So that sounds like a really great investment. We've also done analysis to see how many of these algorithms are really deployed at a large scale. And we do this basically by looking at insurance claims. There are specific claims that when an algorithm, AI algorithm is used to get reimbursement, they will actually file like a claim for that specific CPT code that's tagged to that particular algorithm. So when we looked at this across billions of insurance claims, we actually find that even though there are over 500 medical AI devices that are approved, so they could potentially be used on patients, only a handful, like less than five, have actually seen significant deployments across the country, across different hospitals. So this really highlights the fact that there's a huge gap from the development to deployment. All right, so we're very good now at developing these algorithms and even getting FDA approvals, but to actually deploying them at a scale across different hospitals, diverse populations, in the US and in other countries has really been, I think, currently the biggest challenge.
What do you think are the biggest factors in that gap?
Yeah, so I think there are multiple factors that come in, some related to the economics, other related to the more technical parts. But on the technical side, one of the challenges with AI is to ensure that it works reliably and robustly across diverse populations. So, you know, for example, maybe I develop an algorithm and train it here at Stanford and test it on Stanford patients, that works really well. But if I now deploy the algorithm at a different hospital, right, in the East Coast or in the Midwest or in Florida, maybe the patient population there could be different, or maybe even the kinds of devices that are used in these hospitals to collect the data could be different. Maybe they have different imaging protocols. And all of those differences could potentially lead to the algorithms to make more mistakes, right? To maybe lead to some false positives or false negatives that could affect the patient outcomes. But that's one of the biggest, I think, challenges is to really develop these algorithms to ensure that they're very robust, so that even if there are different perturbations or different artifacts in the input data, the algorithms can still make reliable predictions in the output. Right, so that's sort of one big technical challenge, and that's a problem that we and our collaborators are very much working on. I think on the economics and regulatory side, there's also been several important barriers towards deployment. On the economic side, for these algorithms to be financially sustainable, right, so they have to be able to be reimbursed by insurance companies, right, and to do this, they have to get these like CPT codes. So that's really been a more involved, longer process. I think we've seen a lot of cases where the companies, especially startups who develop these algorithms, they have enough resources to get the algorithm developed, maybe to get FDA approval, but they don't have enough resources to really get it deployed at large scale or to go through all these additional hurdles to get economic reimbursement so that it becomes sustainable, economically incentivized for them to do that. On the regulatory side, that's the third factor, is that I think these algorithms are also presents new regulatory challenges, right? For example, the regulators like the FDA, you know, they are much more comfortable at evaluating things like pharmaceuticals or therapeutics or even softwares, right? Pre-AI softwares. They have a lot of experience doing that. But AI algorithm is, I think, quite different from pharmaceuticals or vaccines or softwares. One big difference is that AI algorithms, by its nature, they are learning algorithms, right? So these algorithms learn from data, they can change over time. So the model's behavior can change and can drift, right? So it's been sort of an interesting challenge for the regulator to think about how do we then regulate and evaluate, you know, these complex objects, complex models, like whose behavior can potentially change over time.
What I think was really interesting is on your first two factors, the economics and the technical challenges, those sound like the same challenges that are faced by non-AI devices and methods. I think about every field of science is experiencing something of a reproducibility crisis and a generalizability crisis, which could be one and the same. And so it was interesting to hear from you that AI tools are experiencing a similar generalizability crisis. Is that a fair characterization of what you said?
That's right. Yeah, I think AI is experiencing generalization challenge. And that challenge for AI might be even larger than the challenge is for other software systems, right? So for example, like if somebody writes a software system for a web browser, because the Chrome and different web browsers are pretty standardized across different laptops, right? So you still do unit testing and make sure that that software is robust, but you can sort of deploy it at a large scale, right? As long as you make it compatible with the standard other web browsers. The challenge with AI is that there's not really because it's still relatively new, there's not really these standardized platforms, right? So like every hospital, when they deploy this algorithm, they have to make sure these algorithms are integrated into their own EHR workflow, into their own system. And different hospitals, right, they might have different versions of EHRs, and they have their different tricks and different tweaks too that needs to be made. So that makes it actually harder, and that exacerbates this generalization challenge that you mentioned.
Fascinating. And then what I do think might be new is that regulatory side, because the FDA has folks who are approving medical devices. And so those folks are knowledgeable about how traditional medical devices work and probably knowledgeable about physiology and medicine. But as AI comes into play, are we going to have to see AI experts become part of the FDA, or are AI models going to have to get much easier to explain to non-experts? Which of those paths do you think we'll see?
It's a good question. I think there will be a need, and there's already a need for there to be more AI experts working with the regulators, either directly within the FDA or through some sort of collaborations between FDA and academics or with industry. And I think the biggest challenge, as you mentioned, that faces the AI is to think about what are the changes to the current regulatory framework that needs to be made to account for AI that's different from other softwares? And I think one of the active debates right now in the FDA and also in the Congress is around how do we do continuous evaluation and monitoring of AI algorithms, right? If the algorithm gets updated, do the companies need to submit another application, right, for these algorithms? Because that itself can be take a long time, it can take a year, it can be very expensive. On the one hand, we don't want to disincentivize AI companies from making updates to their model, because that would basically reduce limits one of the core capabilities of the algorithms. On the other hand, we want to see how do we allow companies to update their algorithms in a relatively low friction way, but still ensure that the algorithms' behavior are robust and safe across time.
On that note of evaluating the algorithms, in an editorial written by Dr. Ryan Godwin, he and I commented on the quality metrics in healthcare AI. What are your views on incorporating metrics beyond sensitivity, specificity, accuracy, AUC, when evaluating AI models, and in particular, how do factors like cost, mortality, and medical ethics fit in?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think a lot of that depends on what is the output of the AI model and how it's being used, and what is the context it's being used. If the algorithm is sort of making relatively clean predictions, if it's just making a binary prediction, then many of the metrics you mentioned, like accuracy, sensitivity, specificity, are relevant metrics to look at. What's interesting is that we're seeing these more complex AI models, for example, like ChatGPT, right? So many clinicians are starting to use ChatGPT, and the output of ChatGPT is not just a simple yes or no answer, right? So the output can be a text, and we have used it to actually write entire clinical trial protocols or to write, you know, medical consent forms. So the output can be very rich. So there are the interesting questions, like, for example, if you're using a large language model where the output is itself like a complicated text, then what are the right ways to evaluate? What are the right metrics to even look at, right, to evaluate the output of the text? And one really interesting thing that we've found recently is that even the, you know, there's very complex behavioral changes in ChatGPT over time, right, that goes beyond sensitivity or accuracy. We, for example, we've seen that its performance on like some of these US medical licensing exams has decreased over time over the last 3 months. Moreover, its ability to provide sort of step-by-step logical reasoning for some of the more reasoning problems has also changed substantially over time over the last few months, right? So these are the kinds of changes, behavioral changes, that would not be well captured just by looking at accuracy or sensitivity metrics.
It's interesting that you brought up the change in behavior. I watched a lecture by a Microsoft researcher titled Sparks of Artificial Generalized Intelligence, which I think was a bit of a clickbait title in some ways. But the researcher posited that the reason you saw, or we were seeing, changes in behavior from generative AI like ChatGPT is that the folks who make it have been trying to make it safer, and that in their steps to make it talk less about what they consider dangerous topics, it's affecting its performance across all topics. What do you think of that hypothesis?
So I think it's an interesting hypothesis, and we've seen some evidence of this in our own works. Right? So we have some research projects where we have taken these large language models to tune them to this process we call instruction fine-tuning, to basically make them safer so that they are less willing to respond to these dangerous questions like, you know, how do I kill someone, or how do I steal someone's credit card? And exactly as you mentioned, in the process of making these language models and generative AI safer, that also leads to all sorts of other really interesting, surprising behavior changes in these models. Right? So for example, now if I ask it, like, how do I kill weed, right? So the algorithm would say, well, you shouldn't kill weed because killing is bad, right? It sort of, in that case, became sort of like overly safe, that in a way that actually reduces its utility to the users. So I think that these two are really interesting complexity with the more modern AI algorithms, like these complex large language models. What I like to call sort of like a, you know, a neural network analog of pleiotropy, whereby changing its behavior in one dimension, right, maybe making it safer, can have all sorts of unexpected consequences that affects its other phenotypes. And I think that's like a really interesting challenge that we don't quite know from the regulatory and from the monitoring side of what's the best way to evaluate that.
So building on that and bringing us a little back to the medical field, how can the medical field play a significant role in shaping the metrics by which we judge generative AI? And are there any potential benefits or challenges you foresee in the development of those metrics?
Previously, we have been mostly relying on these more standard relatively simple scores, right? Like F1 score, AUC, accuracy, sensitivity. Because those are easy to compute, they're relatively objective. And I think we do need to change from going to go beyond those simple scores into more holistic behavioral evaluations done by actual humans, right? So this might involve actually having clinicians, maybe teams of clinicians, to independently evaluate behaviors of these AI algorithms. And ideally, we want to have humans evaluate these algorithms in the context of their clinical workflow, right? Because the previous evaluations have been mostly done on just taking the AI algorithm and evaluating it in isolation on some benchmark AI data sets that did not actually have human in the loop evaluations. So one of the areas that I'm really pushing forward is to really have clinicians to use these algorithms in their daily flow, right? That I think that's really the best way to assess how much do the algorithms really affect the clinician's decision-making process and what are the improvements that can be attributed to the algorithm in this entire human AI team.
I think that relates to the general integration of AI into healthcare, which I think is already proceeding at a bit of a breakneck pace. How do you envision AI in healthcare in the next decade? And are there specific areas where right now you think we have yet to see the AI potential?
Yeah, so I think the next 5 to 10 years will be extremely exciting when we think about AI in healthcare and in medicine. In the next few years, I think still the focus will be on developing and deploying AI that can automate different diverse parts of the medical and healthcare workflow. Right, so take everything from patients' recruitment to clinical trials to improving decision-making process for clinicians. Right, so I think a lot of these different parts can be improved potentially with reliable AI algorithms and models. Right, so there's I think a big focus that at least for the next 5 years will still be on developing these algorithms and evaluating them and testing them and deploying those. I think a big change that we'll see over the next 10 years will be especially trying to leverage these more language capabilities of the AI models, right? Like the fact that they are ChatGPT type models that are very good as conversational agents, I think opens up a lot of really interesting possibilities and new capabilities for AI. Now, instead of having somebody have to write code and script, right, to interact with these models, you can sort of talk to the algorithms. I see we talk to humans, right? I can ask the algorithm to say, okay, find me all of the patients that had breast cancer and took this particular treatment, right, to see what is their outcome. And the algorithm can, the language model can try to go and find those cohorts of patients. I think that's the interesting capabilities of having these natural language interfaces that we really want to leverage and to explore in the next few years.
Do you think it will really be like talking to a human, or do you think that there will be a syntax of language models? I've seen many job posts for prompt engineers with generative AI. Do you think that we are going to have to learn how to talk to these things, or are they going to learn how to talk to us better?
I think we're in an interesting transition period where we have to keep in mind that these ChatGPT and these large language models are still very new, right? ChatGPT really came out in the last 6 months, and it's changing very quickly, as we saw in its behaviors. So first thing I should mention is that, and I don't really expect these prompt engineering jobs to be a very sustainable and long-term lifestyle and career, just because the behaviors models changes, you know, on the orders of weeks, right? So then the kinds of prompting strategies also can be very different now versus what might be in September. You know, it's hard to keep up, but I think the trend is that we will probably either see the AI try to align itself better with humans, right? So that's humans do not have to change our syntax and conversation very much. We can just talk to AI the way that we talk to each other. I think that's more likely than in the other direction of humans have to align ourselves to AI, which would involve like we trying to change our conversation strategies and prompting strategies to better interact with AI algorithms. I think it's easier to align the algorithm to the humans rather than the other direction.
That makes a lot of sense to me. Yeah, it's easier to teach the machine than teach the people how to use the machine.
Yes.
So I want to get your reaction to this statement. With the exception of the follow-up questions, all of the questions you just answered were written by a generative AI.
I'm not actually not surprised by that. I think the generative AI are very good at certain things, right? And they're very good at mimicking humans, for example, in coming up with questions and even coming up with answers. I should say that all of the answers that were provided were written by human, by myself, and not by AI. But that might change maybe when we do our next podcast in a few months. But yeah, these language models, I mean, since they're trained on such a huge corpus of text, which includes millions of questions, I think they could actually come up with very reasonable and insightful questions.
Many scholarly publishers are implementing policies regarding authorship and AI. And I wonder, in light of your other comments and discussion of AI text generators, if you can share what your thoughts are on this subject about AI and authorship.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting and timely discussion. Thanks for bringing that up. So one thing I should mention just as a context is that I think it's going to be increasingly difficult for us to distinguish whether something's written by AI or by humans. We have actually done studies of this. Like currently there are companies that provide what are called AI detectors, right? That you can give a piece of text and these AI detectors are supposed to tell you whether it's written by AI or by human. We actually evaluated those AI detectors and found that really across the board, all of these detectors are not very good. There are many texts that are actually written by humans that are falsely flagged as AI generated. And also vice versa, right? So we shouldn't really trust these detectors. And I think that's just going to get even more challenging, as Ryan mentioned, as these algorithms become more and more aligned to their human behaviors, right? Just, you know, for many of the things, especially scientific writings, it's going to be hard to tell whether it's going to be written by AI or by human. With that as a backdrop, I think it's going to be very difficult logistically, right, for publishers, even for reviewers, right, to be able to distinguish whether something is really written by AI or by human. I think that can be both an opportunity and also challenging, right? I think it's an opportunity in a sense that, you know, there are many types of texts, especially scientific writings, where maybe the human authors would do benefit from AI's support. AI can also be very helpful at finding relevant references, right? You can ask AI now to search through PubMed and try to extract information. Then soon enough, I think it will also be able to help us to generate figures, right? It can create codes, right, that can generate nice plots, right, that's conformant with journals' expectations and guidelines. There are responsible ways to use AI, right, to help to improve the scientific output or to improve the writing quality, to make the writing more precise, more concise, and to generate reproducible figures. We don't want to discourage people from doing that, to use AI in those fruitful ways, because that would be detrimental to the scientific output, but also it would just be very difficult to reinforce. Right? But I think in the same time, we also want to be careful and to educate and set an expectation of what are responsible ways to use AI, use language models in their writing, right? And what are maybe some guidance and best practices of doing that. We still certainly want to have human have the final responsibility of the papers that they write and the papers that they submit, right? They should still be responsible for the veracity of every statement that they made. But if the statements are sort of polished by the AI algorithm to make it more precise, then maybe that's okay as long as the human still takes the final responsibility.
Awesome. I took some notes as we were going along and now have what I might call a series of rapid fire questions if we want to engage in a little bit of a lightning round.
Yeah, sounds good. Let's do it.
So first, you used a term earlier that referred to changes in one specific area causing unexpected changes in other areas. I think it was a genetic term. What was that term you used?
Pleiotropy. Which in genetics, for example, like there are many genes in the human genome that have the same gene can have many different phenotype effects, right? Maybe the same gene can affect both my cardiovascular phenotypes, can also affect my skin tones, right? I think that complexity of many phenotypes being affected by the same building blocks, in genetics, we call that pleiotropy. And we're seeing the same behavior in AI in that, you know, maybe the same artificial neurons in the network can affect many different behaviors.
All right. AGI, what is it and how close are we to it?
Artificial general intelligence. That's what people often refer to as AGI. My personal thinking is that I think we are still not very close, right? Even the large language models like ChatGPT, I would not consider those to be AGI. And it's not clear right now that the strategy for training large language models like ChatGPT will get us to AGI.
How will we know we've achieved AGI? What's the hypothesis that we test?
I think the lines become increasingly blurry. In the past, people have relied on more conversation tests. Like if you can talk to a chatbot and if it sounds like a human, then maybe that's good enough. I think that's ChatGPT has already passed that bar. I think we have to look for more cognitive tasks. Like, does the model really understand what I mean, right? And can it really interact with me? And can it have really creative outputs? right? So I think there's still a debate on like how creative really is ChatGPT and these language models, and or this is really mostly still memorize and regurgitate what has read before. So I think creativity would likely be maybe the next bar for AGI.
There are some even very highly credentialed groups expressing fear of existential risk from AI. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of interesting debates by thoughtful people across the community around the different risks of AGI and of AI. I think there are actually some important short-term implications and potential risks of AI, especially in medicine, that's definitely worthwhile for us to pay attention to, right? So this relates to, for example, we want to ensure that these algorithms we build work reliably well across diverse populations of patients and clinicians. And so that's actually a very concrete and very real risk and challenge facing many of the existing medical AI algorithms. So I think there are, even setting aside these longer term risks, I think there are actually very concrete and immediate short-term challenges that's important for the community to address to improve the trustworthiness of the AI models.
What about authorship? For example, am I the author of the questions that I asked you earlier?
I think that's an interesting one. I think if the question is generated by AI, as you did, it's actually good for you to be transparent and to acknowledge that. But at the same time, you know, I think you are still sort of taking control of the flow of the conversations, right? And you are still taking responsibility for the follow-up and for the questions that you ask. And so in that sense, I would still say that you are in charge of this podcast and this interview with the assistance of maybe of the AI algorithm.
I wonder where that metaphor breaks down. And I'm reminded of a joke that I saw online recently, where a person goes to a fast food chain, orders a cheeseburger with no tomatoes, no lettuce, and then presents the cheeseburger as, I made this cheeseburger using a fast food chain as a tool. Is that what we're doing when we say, I wrote these questions using an AI as a tool?
Well, I guess we'll have to see what whoever that ends up eating that cheeseburger thinks. And if that person is satisfied with the cheeseburger or is not satisfied, then maybe you don't want to claim that you're responsible for that cheeseburger. But I think it's a good question. I think a lot of that really does come down to the transparency of the process, right? So if that person actually described that, I'm responsible for the instructions to the fast food restaurant, but the cheeseburger is actually made at McDonald's, then yeah, if you're transparent, then that's fine. You just don't want to sort of misrepresent that and give the impression that I made the cheeseburger from scratch because I've been to the farm myself and I baked the bread myself.
Yeah, and that raises the question of, say, the person who ate the cheeseburger got food poisoning. Now we really want to know who's responsible. And obviously that extends into the medical field with malpractice.
Exactly.
One question that I've actually gotten a surprising amount from folks in my home department is, how do I pick what to go play with? And the specific thing they're asking for is, they have no context for judging the quality of these models that often ask you to pay to use them. You know, I've told people go play with ChatGPT, that it's the best in class at the moment. But in general, since many of these things require you to actually pay money, how should folks judge the quality and decide what to give their money to and what not?
Yeah, so I think this is where having independent third parties that can systematically evaluate and compare these many language models will be really important, right? So something like akin to a consumer report. You know, it's hard for me to figure out like, what is the best laptop or best car to get, but then I rely on these more respected third parties that have some independence, right? That have done the systematic evaluations of different cars and provides different scorecards, right? I think we need that kind of similar kind of setup for things like generative AI, right? Now there, like every week, there seems to be new large language models coming out, right? From different companies, from different startups. It's a really fast moving space. And actually many of the research that we do and our colleagues do here is focused on trying to come up with, keeping track of that and providing more like systematic and holistic evaluations of language models.
What excites you the most about the field right now?
I think we're in this space where suddenly we have all these really cool and very powerful technologies. And in some sense, we're really limited by our creativity of what we can do with this. Right? So even take something like ChatGPT, there are so many different ways that one can think about using them in a way to improve the medical process. And we have to be just more creative in coming up with different projects, different ideas, right? And then we can try to help it to use it for medical education, right? So take something that's maybe written in more jargony ways, so it's that hard for patients to understand, and use ChatGPT to explain that, to simplify it and to explain that back to the patients, which for things like consent forms have actually been quite useful for patients.
What concerns you the most?
I think the concerns that's sort of like this line from Spider-Man, right, was great power comes great responsibility, is that on the one hand, these technologies like ChatGPT are becoming more accessible and very powerful. The other side of the coin is that as they become even more accessible, right, there's also greater risk for potentially misusing it, either inadvertently misusing it or even maliciously being used by certain actors. Right. So for example, now it is relatively easy for people to use these generative models to create fake documents or fake images relatively quickly. Right. So that's something that I think have potentially large negative impacts.
It's been an enlightening discussion talking about the transformative potential of AI in healthcare. Thank you, James, for your valuable insights and for your significant contributions to the field.
Thank you, Ryan and Kara. Really enjoyed the discussion.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Physiological Reviews podcast. For more episodes like this one, visit journals.physiology.org/journal/physrev or subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and Spotify.